We have profound financial illiteracy when it comes to investing in the innovation economy. We need to fix all of these things.
You have got somewhere.
By New Palo Alto, we're talking about an innovation cluster that, after Old Palo Alto, the Bay Area, is the second biggest innovation cluster globally in terms of venture capital, in terms of startups. And we want to be a different Silicon Valley.
Britain supposedly is broken, many argue. But there's one area where Britain is unambiguously not broken, the British innovation economy. The incredible numbers of so-called scale-ups, fast-growing young companies that are growing fast, or scaling, that innovation economy has created, and the new investment industry, venture capital, that's supporting them. To give some idea of the numbers, Britain boasts the biggest venture capital industry in Europe, a 21st century industry that's regarded as indispensable to the innovation economy, and two-fifths of Europe's successful scale-ups. Some of the companies, Monzo and Moo, may be familiar, but Wren, Yapily, Laka, less so. But all of them, or at least some of them, could grow into the great companies of tomorrow. In the increasingly urgent debate about how to raise Britain's dismal economic growth rate, productivity and living standards, one answer stares us in the face. There's no economic growth without a critical mass of fast-growing companies like these. We need more of them. We need them to grow independently to maturity, and as many as possible to stay anchored in Britain. What those particular companies all have in common is that they were all invested in and nurtured by the varying venture capital funds created by the venture capital company Phoenix Court. It was co-founded and is led by the man sitting opposite me, Saul Klein. We're sitting in his London office in Summertown, King's Cross, one of the most deprived wards in London. He was recently identified as the world's most successful venture capitalist outside the United States. Serial entrepreneur turned top investor, he's used that platform to become one of the UK's leading voices on innovation, technology, and long-term economic growth. Saul, welcome to the We Society podcast. Do you recognize that introduction, and in particular, the description of venture capital?
Well, thank you first for having me. And yeah, I mean, I think having grown up metaphorically in Silicon Valley in the 90s.
When you say metaphorically, what do you mean?
I mean, I was born in South Africa. I grew up in the UK, but professionally, I grew up in Silicon Valley in the 90s. And so I absolutely recognize the fact that venture capital is the growth engine that has put America certainly on the dominated the global economy over the last 50 to 60 years. So the idea that Britain...
I think all the famous Mag 7 were venture capital backed.
Yeah, if you look at the 10 biggest companies in the world today, 7 or 8 of the 10 were venture backed and didn't exist 50 years ago. So I think what's incredible about the economy that we've been living in, even for the last 20 to 30 years, is that it's an economy that is based on venture capital. It's an economy that is based on innovation. What is incredible about Britain, in spite of so many of the challenges that we have, is that we have the world's third best, by any measure, innovation economy after the US and China.
It's not widely known. And I should declare my answer to this discussion that, and you're one of the kind of 7 companies that backed the growth trilogy run by the Purcell Company, which I became kind of aware of this myself. I was unaware of it until then. Here you are. I mean, you're the most successful venture capitalist outside the United States, and hardly anybody knows about you or the industry or about the innovation economy. I mean, presumably, you've made a significant amount of money, but how much of that has gone to British funds who invested in you?
Well, I mean, there are lots of different questions there. So, I mean, let's start with why does no one understand the role that venture capital plays in economic growth? You know, I remember doing a piece in maybe 2010 with Jonathan Moole, who was wrote a piece for the FT Weekend magazine where he followed me for a week. And, you know, part of the, I think, idea behind the piece was to say there is this black box called venture capital that is finding young companies, that is, you know, generating growth. but no one knows about it. And even those that do know about it, they think it's like Dragon's Den or The Apprentice. And I think, you know, the role that venture capital plays in economies, really, other than in the US, has been very, very low-key and or invisible. And to be fair, in the UK, where our venture capital economy is maybe only 20 years old, it's only really been in the last 5 years that the evidence or the seeds that were planted 15, 20 years ago have started to grow up, that we can see these 1800, as we call them, cults, companies doing between 25 and 100 million in revenue, or thoroughbreds, companies doing over 100 million in revenue.
That's $1 million.
$1 million. So, you know, revenue, $100 million in annual revenue.
That's substantial.
It's substantial. And again, these are companies, these 1800 companies across the UK that just didn't exist 25, 30 years ago. And Britain, in spite of all of our challenges in the city, and I would point our challenges squarely at the city and at Whitehall,
yeah,
the city of London, this old square mile, as we would call it, you know, those two institutional vectors that get together every year through the Mansion House, you know, have basically kept Britain back. And so in spite of being the world's third best innovation economy, we do not invest in ourselves. Who invests in us? Teachers from Ontario through their pension system, nurses from Denmark through their pension system, the Singapore Metro system through GIC or Temasek, or the Saudi royal family through PIF. Do we invest in ourselves? No. We've got £6 trillion sitting in the UK not investing in our innovation economy. 1% of the capital that could be allocated towards our own innovation economy is coming from those capital allocators that are looking after my long-term savings, your long-term savings, and, you know, anyone in Britain who is listening to this podcast, your retirement is being looked after by people who are sitting in the world's third best innovation economy and not investing in it.
How upset do you get then about the debates, you know, in the House of Commons and House of Lords when venture funds were being required to kind of invest up to 10% of their investment in risk capital in British scale-ups and overseas scale-ups? I mean, how do you feel kind of sitting here as a successful venture capitalist, made money for all those people that you've described and not for British pensioners?
So, you know, many of the investors in our funds are British, to be clear. And we welcome long-term, value-aligned British investors in our funds. Nothing would make us happier. However, I'm saying at an institutional level, you know, our funds, you know, make up tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of what could be allocated domestically. And I think, you know, all of the data demonstrates, and I've been on the Prime Minister's Council for Science and Technology for 6 years now, which I think so far 4 prime ministers, 6 chancellors, 8 science ministers. We made the case in 2021, it's on GovUK, you know, being in a liberal democracy, all of the independent advice that the Council for Science and Technology provides to the Prime Minister and other cabinet ministers is publicly available on our websites, government websites. We made the case and we said, look, we've got an incredible innovation economy. Our pension funds are too small. We don't have scaled up sovereign wealth vehicles. We don't have a private to public pathway for the London Stock Exchange. We have profound illiteracy, financial illiteracy when it comes to investing in the innovation economy. We need to fix all of these things. I would say
You have got somewhere.
Well, we have got somewhere. Glass half full, 5 years later, actually, you know, the pensions minister, not just the Labour pensions minister, but the previous Conservative pensions minister were consolidating pension funds. You know, previous Conservative chancellor, now Labour chancellor, through the Mansion House Compact, now through, you know, doubling the commit with the
Mansion. Just explain the Mansion House Compact.
So the Mansion House Compact was a was an initiative actually pioneered by Sir Nick Lyons, who is the chair of Standard Life, used to be Phoenix Group. When Sir Nick Lyons was the mayor of the City of London, he brought together 2 or 3 years ago different key stakeholders from the city, Phoenix, Aviva, M&G, L&G, and Schroders. And collectively, they said, we will commit 5% of our assets under management to invest in the innovation economy broadly by 2030. When Rachel Reeves became chancellor, she secured a doubling of what Jeremy Hunt had had at 5% to 10%, and actually supported the British Business Bank that is chaired by Stephen Welton, great CEO with Louis Bacon, you know, to help pension funds be more comfortable allocating capital to the innovation economy, created the British Growth Partnership, which is the first time the FCA, the financial regulator, has allowed a arm's length body of the government, the British Business Bank, to manage third-party capital, because previously it had only been able to manage treasury funds. You know, I would argue, and then with the Regulatory Innovation Office that Patrick Malance, you know, has led on, and we are now at a point actually where we understand domestically that we need to channel capital and be more progressive from a regulatory point of view to support this world-class innovation economy. So if you're asking me, will funds meaningfully start to flow by 2030 or maybe 2035? I would say absolutely. If you ask me, are they flowing today? The answer is no, other than from two sources, M&G with their Catalyst program, and to a greater or lesser extent, the British Business Bank, especially now the Sovereign AI Unit has come about.
There's two big questions on my mind. One is to kind of interrogate you about why you're so hopeful about what might happen in the next 6-7 years. Before we get there, I think you should explain to, or it might be great if you could explain to listeners, what a venture capitalist like you does. What do you actually do that is particular and unique?
So as a English literature graduate, investing in science, engineering, and technology for the last 33 years, I would describe what we do very simply is we invest in practical science fiction. What do I mean by that? When people present us with an idea, it's often a blank piece of paper and their thoughts, it sounds like science fiction. It sounds like this is crazy, it's never going to happen, and if it does happen, it may happen 20 years from now. The practical bit is our judgment is whether this is literally just science fiction or it could be practical. It could be something, whether in financial services or quantum or AI or advanced materials or space or photonics, that actually practically delivers impact and value over a 10 to 20 year time horizon. And this is the thing that I think people don't always appreciate about venture capital, is that it is a very long-term asset class. So, you know, when you are investing at seed stage, which is where our local Globe Fund invests, and you mentioned that we had invested in 20 plus companies that, you know, got to $100 million of annual revenue, that's just from seed stage. We've actually invested in 35 companies that have got to 100 million in revenue. But, you know, the really tricky thing is when someone, a founder, comes to you with an idea that sounds to 99.9% of other people like literally science fiction, and you're saying, okay, well, here's some capital to help you go on that 20-year journey. And that's what we do at Phoenix Quartz. You know, we try and, you know, do that, and 60% of our investments or more at that seed stage. And then we try and support those founders through early growth stage, We call that fund Latitude. And then at scale-up stage, Solar, when they're 3 or 4 years away from an IPO. So effectively, our goal is to find these founders, we call them surfers, who are capable of riding a 20-year wave at seed stage, i.e. when they're on the beach, and then, you know, help them build their businesses into the hillsides and all the way to the city and beyond. I mean, if you think Malibu Beach, you know, we are not, we live on the beach with the surfers at seed stage. We don't have some fancy beachfront property, you know, but we're helping people all the way on the journey. And so what we do is in innovation sectors.
What skills are required to spot these companies and then to kind of help the founders build the team, kind of open up orders for them, markets for them?
I mean, to say they're companies at that stage is, I mean, they're founders. And so our focus is on founders. You know, our focus is on entrepreneurs, founders, innovators, people who have what most people would think of as science fiction type ideas. But we think, you know, with our support and with their resilience, drive, ambition, etc., become something that's meaningful. So, you know, there are many. I was on the tube the other day.
You have money, though, you invest in. That's one thing you do. But it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there is so much money available to the best founders. You know, there are 20,000 active VCs or investors, and I think 23 out of the 20,000 have invested in more than 10 companies from seed stage that get to 100 million in revenue. So 0.13%.
Is that when you say 23,000, is that a UK number? Or
no, it's a global number. A global number. There are 23 out of 20,000, 0.13 funds have invested in more than 10 companies that reach that 100 million revenue status from the beach, from seed stage. If you're doing that, and we're one of those 23 globally, so, you know, to consistently pick what in venture capital, and Sebastian Mallaby's written a great book on this called The Power Law, but these power law outcomes is extremely, extremely rare. And so it's not just about money, it's about, you know, the network, the support in terms of opening up new markets, access to follow-on capital. I mean, just today, if I'm looking at the pipeline of follow-on investments in our portfolio over the next 90 days, there's $2 billion of interest in our portfolio following us over the next 90 days. So one of the things we're working with, the 10 or 15 companies who have all of that
money coming at
inbound interest, is like, well, who should you take the money from? You know, who are the most strategic people to give that money to you? Because again, money is not the issue for these great companies. The great issue is like long-term shared value investors. You know, what they would say in the Bay Area is smart money. The glass half empty part of the $6 trillion is not that it's not here in the UK. It's just that it's a long way today from being smart money. So even when and if the money comes in the next 5 years, still the best founders and the best funds will struggle to take that money domestically because it's not as sophisticated, it's not as value-add, quite frankly, as Canadian, Australian, Singaporean, Danish, German, French, you know, Japanese, Korean, dare I even say American.
There's lots of things to follow up here. I mean, my mind is racing as I hear you speak. Vital that these companies that we've got, the number is at least 800.
It's 1,800, Will, is the new data.
And
we can beat it up as much as you like over the next 3 to 6 months. And you can we can squeeze the growth rates down, but there are 1,800 companies.
It's an incredible
that
number.
Have passed, that have been venture-backed, just venture-backed, that have passed that $25 million a year revenue threshold. And as you know, because we've discussed it, it's across the UK. They're more in Leeds than in Cambridge. They're more in Manchester than in Oxford.
That's one of the things that's striking about this, is that actually this 1,800 companies are all over the country. I mean, they're a potential kind of way of rejuvenating
the economy.
Not just in, you know, London, the Southeast, which is always the story, but actually everywhere.
Yeah.
It's kind of such a kind of optimistic and kind of tantalizing prospect. How many of these do you think realistically will get to kind of independent maturity and be substantive companies? Over the last kind of 15 years, at least 1,700 of such companies have actually been bought and sold overseas, mainly to the Americans. We estimate it could be as much as £1 trillion worth of velocity economic value. Some of them had to go to America because that's where, you know, the markets were and the growth was, but many didn't. And what's your
look?
Reflect on that for me.
I think we've discussed this. My reflection is that, and there's a great book called Vassal State that sort of lays out how, since the 40s, really, the US has sort of economically hollowed out. I'm not saying this is mean or intentional, the British economy. So in all sectors of the British economy, media, retail, everything, even first folios of Shakespeare, you know, it's all US owned. If you go to the Folger Shakespeare Library, which is about half a mile from the White House, and Folger was one of, I guess, kind of Carnegie or Rockefeller's COO, basically 70% of the world's first folios of Shakespeare are there. It's the greatest collection of medieval, pre-Renaissance British English literature there. And why? Because in the 20s, between the wars, on grand tours, people came shopping in Europe. You know, why is Leeds Castle owned by an American? Because we've basically been selling our assets for over 100 years. So I don't think, you know, there's anything new in that. What I think is really interesting, and I think, you know, someone we both know, Michelle Osterman, actually—
the former chief executive of the Pension Protection Fund.
One of the things that Michelle said, which I think has been a light bulb for me, you know, when the capital is not domestic, but not American, i.e. when it's Canadian, when it's Australian, when it's Singaporean, when it's Japanese, when it's Korean, even when it's German, French, Danish, no one is moving from the UK. So I think, you know, actually it's quite nuanced. I think the, you know, Americans tend to try move companies, whereas everyone else I've mentioned are very happy, you know, not just to keep investing here. And to be fair, if you look at Google, if you look at Amazon, if you look at Accenture, if you look at IBM, if you look at Cisco, all of these people employ tens of thousands of people in the UK. They pay meaningful taxes. You know, Demis would not have had the investment.
Demis has to be.
Demis at DeepMind would not have had the investment he needed to sort of, you know, not just build one of the great AI companies in the world with DeepMind, but now spin out with Isomorphic without the long-term capital investment of an American business.
He's hoping Isomorphic will be the Britain's first $1 trillion company.
I guess what I'm saying is that, what do we mean by Britain's company? So are these companies employing British people? Yes. Are these companies that have British investors? No. And that's where I think we need to sort of differentiate between, you know, actually these companies that are very successful and are growing, both born in Britain and then invested in or even bought by non-domestic buyers. And we need to just like part the clouds and say the real problem here is the people who don't either understand this or don't care are people in Whitehall and people in the city.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday. Find them wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you've worked in Whitehall, the Council of Science and Technology, and you know the city well. I mean, there's some, you know, you've got some city money.
I don't really know the city well.
Well, you've got some city investors.
Rounding errors. We'd love, you know, more domestic, as I said, smart money, aligned money. But, you know, we're a business as well.
I know that you also think that it's possible for Britain not just to build an innovation economy, but some of these companies are kind of have a different approach to innovation and a different way to how they organize themselves. They're much more inclusive in the way they kind of set themselves up and the founders think in those terms. I mean, just describe that, because I think it's a very kind of rich vein of your thinking.
So, you know, we've talked for 5 or 6 years now, maybe just to kind of be annoying to the Americans, about New Palo Alto. And we, by New Palo Alto, we're talking about a innovation cluster that after Old Palo Alto, the Bay Area, is the second biggest innovation cluster globally in terms of venture capital, in terms of startups, in terms of R&D intensity. Many, many inputs go into that. And basically, New Palo Alto is a 5-hour train ride from Somerstown. So it's, you know, north, it's Glasgow, Edinburgh, Leeds, Manchester, etc. You know, west, it's sort of Swansea, Bristol, Exeter. South, it's Southampton. And then across the channel, it's, you know, it's Paris, it's Aachen in Germany, it's the Eindhoven Photonics Cluster. And this supercluster, New Palo Alto, is the second best innovation cluster in the world. But when I've spoken to chancellors over the last, I don't know, decade or more, they're like, oh, when are we going to have our first trillion-dollar company? When are we going to be the next Silicon Valley? And my view is we don't want to be the next Silicon Valley. We want to be a different Silicon Valley. And the difference is that, you know, we want to have values, inclusive values, sorry to swear, where there is more equitable distribution, really sorry to swear, between people who are generating economic value and the broader society. And that is the sort of the premise of New Palo Alto. And it's not just a Somerstown premise. It's a premise, you know, in Leeds. It's a premise in Manchester. It's a premise in across the UK. And quite frankly, it's a premise in, you know, look at the area around the Gare du Nord. Look at the areas. So, you know, there are summer towns everywhere. And our principle is that, you know, if you are going to grow economically, it is imperative, even if it's just for sustainability, that you grow inclusively.
Inclusive innovation has been a kind of, you know, you've mentioned it a number of times during the course of the discussion. Explaining inclusive innovation vividly so people get hold of the idea.
So I think the most vivid way for me to sort of explain and understand inclusive innovation is Somerstown, where on one side of the road is the Crick, the British Library, and DeepMind. And on the other side of the road is this incredibly deprived neighborhood.
Where we're sitting at the minute.
Where we're sitting at the minute. And, you know, this is, Somerstown is a ward within Camden. And the idea that, you know, it's not good enough for us just to innovate in Camden, you know, win Nobel Prizes, have big tech companies, but that innovation has to be shared by the local community and by the local residents. To me, that's how I think of inclusive growth and inclusive innovation. We're looking at it at ward level here in Somerstown, but obviously there are Somerstowns all over the UK.
One of the things that impresses me is not just what you're saying, but actually a lot of the founders think similarly.
100%. I've never met a founder that's built something really big. And by really big, I mean in the tens of billions of, you know, that is not motivated by mission. They're missionaries. They are not mercenaries. The people who do this best are the people who are so driven to the mission. They don't care what other people think. I mean, in the UK, a great recent example of this, obviously, is James Dyson, who famously, I think did 50 or 100 revisions and more revisions of a vacuum cleaner that no one thought was worth building, because why would you compete with a generic Hoover? So, the great founders just want to solve a problem that they think is really important.
Give me a sense, and give the listeners a sense, of what you think needs to happen. We've got these universities which are providing some of the science fiction stories that you describe.
Yeah.
You've got the pension funds, I've described that. But, you were pessimistic, or you seem to have a pessimism about you, about whether the smart money that you urgently say is required will actually come through.
I think it will.
Are you going to this podcast on optimistic?
No, look, as I said, by 2030, I'm optimistic that more of this domestic capital will start to flow through, because the pipes have been laid. Medium term, optimistic, and long term, I'm very optimistic. I'm just saying that we shouldn't kid ourselves that in the next 5 years, the domestic capital is going to flow at scale. And, there isn't a shortcut. I really think building a federation, for want of a better word, of value-aligned, long-term partners, is critical to sort of long-term survival, because we're living in a bipolar world between the US and China, and we need friends. And guess what? We've got something that most other people don't have, which is the non-US and the non-Chinese best innovation economy on the planet. That's an asset.
Where does all this come from? Where does your kind of, as a former English graduate, to kind of get engaged with science fiction, as you described it, and then to go on and insist that it's inclusive? I mean, where does this spring from? How do you understand yourself?
I mean, it's obviously how one understands oneself is a perennial question, but I would say, there are obviously two sort of foundational aspects, I guess, to my identity that have contributed to this. One is being Jewish. And I'd say one of the most fundamental aspects of being Jewish, at least I understand it, is to make a positive contribution to the society that you're in. And then the second is having been born in South Africa, apartheid South Africa, and growing up, for my first 6 years in what was patently an unfair society, to the level, not really seen very much in the last 100 years, the idea that that's not okay, and anything you can do to sort of create a more equitable society, I would say those are sort of two identity pillars. And then obviously I have role models, in my parents, in my grandparents, but also probably one of my most fundamental role models is my wife, who is incredibly progressive in terms of how she thinks about inclusivity. She left South Africa later than I did, but she was part of a generation that saw the new constitution in South Africa. And, as a lawyer, albeit as a young lawyer, she really had a front row seat there. And it's so exciting to be in a society where you see that transition from an apartheid state to, a state that probably still has one of the world's most progressive constitutions. And, she is the founder of a charity for refugees and asylum seekers. She did her master's in human rights law at LSE. So, I'm inspired by her as well.
Saul Klein, serial entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and thinker. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistle Down production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.